Good evening and welcome to Women's Hour. I'm Briley Colton, a volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today we'll start off as an O, the Oprah Magazine Day, and then time permitting we will move into women's health for just a little bit. First up is 45 million. That's about how many Americans went hiking in 2017 per the Outdoor Foundation's latest report. And the number is noteworthy for two reasons. It's a steep climb from 37 million in 2016, and nearly half the hikers were female. Some industry experts speculate that the Cheryl Strayed effect has played a part. The author's 2012 bestseller, Wild, a backpacking memoir, turned Oprah's book club pick, turned Reese Witherspoon film, may have inspired fans to blaze their own trails, but you needn't embark on a Strayed-style adventure to find mental clarity outdoors. According to a 2015 Stanford study, people who simply walked in nature, as opposed to in a city, for 90 minutes experienced less rumination and repetitive negative thinking linked to anxiety and depression. Not sure where to go? The national database at americantrails.org will put you on the right path. And this is from me. I began hiking that year because I retired, but also there's an app called All Trails that is great for finding places to hike. And now back to the magazine. Better together, probiotics are only half the 1-2 gut punch equation. We've all received the message that we should feed our belly good bugs. But did you know that the bacteria themselves need to eat too? Probiotics are a type of dietary fiber that fuel the growth and activity of the trillions of healthy microorganisms in your intestines, says Sonia Angelone, a registered dietitian and spokesperson for the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics. And the benefits go beyond your digestive tract. Research suggests that by helping those bacteria thrive, prebiotics may also strengthen your immune system, your heart, and your bones. That's why they're proliferating in packaged snacks and supplements. But the best way to ensure you get enough is to eat a variety of plant-based foods, says Joanne Slavin, a nutrition professor at the University of Minnesota who studies the health effects of prebiotics. These menu moves can up your pregame. Get your whole grains from barley or oats. They're packed with a prebiotic soluble fiber called beta-glucan, which has been shown to lower cholesterol. Go heavy on the garlic and leeks. These root vegetables are high in the prebiotic inulin, as are onions, another potential bacteria booster. And swap your side salad for asparagus. In addition to inulin, you'll get insoluble fiber, which can help keep you regular. How's that for intestinal fortitude? And this was researched by Laurel Leicht. A family affair. Emily Bernard spent much of her adult life resenting her father's mistress, going so far as to plot revenge. Then after decades of bitterness, she realized it was time to do what she never dreamed she could. Forgive. I don't understand why he would buy it for her. My mother sat at the kitchen table while my brothers and I orbited her chair. She kept track of our family finances and had come across a curious receipt. My father had purchased a plane ticket for one of his patients, Jeanette Curie. It doesn't make any sense, my mother said, as much to herself as to us. You worry too much, Mom, I teased. My mother was a fretful person, supervisor of details and predictor of all that could go wrong. I just wanted to change the subject. It was December 1988 at my parents' home in Nashville. I was on winter break from college, and my older brother James was back from New York to spend Christmas with us. My younger brother Warren was a high school senior. As siblings, we had our differences, but we always snapped together like magnets around our mother, whom we uniformly adored. I wanted her to relax and join our reunion, cracking inside jokes the four of us had honed over many years. I was sure my father would eventually explain the ticket. What I didn't know then was that for several years, he had been building a secret life with Jeanette Curie at its center. My father was an OBGYN. He met Jeanette when she was a 24-year-old intern in his practice. She was married and training to become a medical assistant. After she left the position, my father, 30 years older than Jeanette, became her doctor. My mother, who managed the office, was taken by the younger woman's kooky wit. She's quite a character, my mother said of her. Jeanette was what we Southerners describe as colorful, and my mother loved a character. She didn't have a clue about the role this one would play in our lives. In 1988, my mother was 50 years old, 2 years younger than I am now. She had settled into middle age, her long hair streaked with gray and coiled in a bun. She wore smart, unfussy clothing and little makeup. But I prefer to think of her as she was in a photograph from her time at Fisk University. Her wavy hair cascades over her shoulders. Her eyes are large and dark, her lips full and red, with a Marilyn Monroe mole just above. She emanates youthful promise. She's been a brilliant poet. She'd been a brilliant poetry student, mentored by the preeminent African-American poet Robert Hayden. She was accomplished in the sciences, more talented than my father, even, I'd been told. They met at the local church. My mother was passionate about the arts in the early days. They went to movies and museums and poetry readings together. They also shared a commitment to thrift, modesty, and becoming Denizens of Nashville's black upper middle class. When they married, though, my mother tabled any career aspirations in favor of being the perfect doctor's wife. My father had soft, curly hair and strong white teeth. I looked just like him, down to the faintness of his eyebrows and the planes of his face. My smile is his. He was perpetually trim and deeply charismatic and always knew just what he wanted. He inspired with his charm and controlled with his silence. But he was often absent, and that made my parents' marriage difficult. Over the years, my mother grew depressed, and a few months after that Christmas break, Jeanette's phone calls began. Jeanette Curie wouldn't stop calling Mom. I wrote in a 1989 journal in my dorm room at Yale, "Why is she doing this to her?" In the space of a few months, Jeanette had become like a burglar in our home, invading our mother's peace of mind, robbing us of our sense of well-being, phoning at all hours asking to speak with my father. She claimed that her son, Lee, was my father's, which he denied, telling my mother Jeanette was crazy. My mother believed him, so we did, too. But Jeanette was relentless. She brought Lee to my father's office when my mother wasn't there, explaining that the baby needs to see his father. He said Jeanette was just out to get his money. When I came home between semesters, I felt Jeanette's unsettling presence even more. The telephone jangled continuously, jabbing the air like a witch's crooked finger. That's how I'd come to think of Jeanette Curie, like a witch who wanted to do evil to our family. My mother changed our phone number several times, but Jeanette always managed to get the new one. One night, instead of hanging up on her, my mother asked Jeanette, "What do you want from me?" "I want to be the doctor's wife," Jeanette responded. "I want to live in the house on the hill." My mother and I laughed darkly at this. "You have to hand it to Jeanette," Mother told me. "She won't be ignored." A picture from when I was little shows my arms wrapped possessively around my father's neck. Family and friends of his generation remember how close we once were. That ended when I hit puberty, and suddenly I was gripped by emotions I could neither understand nor control. I spent my adolescence fearing my father. It wasn't violence I was afraid of. It was his judgment. I felt his assessing eyes on me constantly. "I hate you," I screamed at him when I was 12. He slapped me solidly across the face. "You are rotten to the core," he said evenly. He didn't speak to me for weeks until my mother insisted I apologize. This routine, an argument, his silence, my compelled "I'm sorry," defined the contours of our relationship. While my mother sympathized with me, he was my father, and so she believed I should defer to him. None of us, including my mother, was permitted to question him. Not once did I ever believe Jeanette Curie was being truthful about my father or her son. It didn't occur to me to doubt my father's word. Jeanette wasn't even a member of our community. My parents socialized exclusively with people like themselves, well-educated, black professional men and their wives. But Jeanette's the youngest of 10 kids. Her mother had her first child at 15. Her father died of tuberculosis when she was one. Jeanette and her family sometimes resorted to welfare to get by, while my father tooled around in his beloved blue Mercedes. He cared about appearances, and the Curies, who lived in East Nashville and moved 8 times in 6 years, seemed like exactly the kind of people my father hadn't wanted us to become. But a few months after the calls began, a paternity test triggered my Child Protective Services, triggered by Child Protective Services, put the lie to it all. Lee was my father's son. Yet my father continued to deny the truth, offering rationales about the fallibility of such tests, which my mother clung to. Then she found a letter in my father's bedside cabinet from his attorney, urging him to stop lying to his wife because it would just make the situation worse. When my mother confronted my father, he waved off his indiscretion as something men were entitled to and suggested we all move on. Even I felt the sting of humiliation and betrayal. My mother, ever a tender and forgiving soul, crumpled. Despite the evidence, she hadn't seen this coming. Afterward, I barely spoke to my father, but the person I blamed was Jeanette. I fantasized about hiring someone to scare her or break her kneecaps. My mother was deeply religious, and our Episcopal church was her solace. She and my father had been married there. My brothers and I were baptized there and later served as acolytes in the chapel. One day in 1989, during a visit home, we were seated in our usual pew at St. Anselm's when there was a stir behind us. It was the Curies walking to a pew not 10 feet from ours. St. Anselm's was a small parish, and rumors had swirled about my father's other son. I felt the gaze of all the churchgoers around us as my dignified mother trained her attention on the Book of Common Prayer, reciting the lines she knew by heart. I suppressed my desire to rip the prayer book from Jeanette Curie's undeserving hands. It would only have embarrassed my mother further. I wanted to cover her body with mine, to shield her from the titillation and scorn. But instead, I seethed. Soon thereafter, my mother stopped going to St. Anselm's. Then so did I. Another reason to hate Jeanette Curie. Despite everything, my parents stayed together. It took a toll on my mother. When she first discovered the affair, she made attempts to get into shape, to do her hair differently, to apply lipstick before my father got home. But now I could see how weary she was. Over the next 2 decades, she developed chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, which severely compromised her breathing. By the end of her life, she rarely left the house. During our last conversation, when she was 70, she sat in an easy chair in the den as I caught her up on news about my husband and 2 daughters. My father came home and asked whether she needed anything, resting a gentle hand on her shoulder. 3 weeks later, she died. My grief was excruciating, made all the harder when I thought of the beautiful college girl with infinite opportunities she'd given up and what she'd settled for. I knew it was a broken heart that had finally killed her. My father and I had grown distant, but just 8 weeks before my mother's death, she urged me, "Don't leave your father out." Still, 8 years later, we remained extremely uncomfortable with each other, but lately, he'd taken an interest in my writing after Reverend Cynthia, St. Anselm's young priest, shared an essay of mine she'd found in an online publication. I was finishing up a book about my family, Black is the Body, and on a whim decided to fly from Vermont, where I was a university professor, to Nashville to reconnect with my father and ask him some questions about our past. Our conversation was awkward, but we both made an effort. I asked what it was like to live in the house where my mother had died nearly a decade before. Not only had he not moved, but he'd kept my mother's pill bottles on the bathroom sink where they'd always been. I'd brought him to the sink to ask why. "I guess I'm still in love with your mother," he said. We stood together, hugging tightly. The next morning, I called my daughters before they left for school. As we chatted, I heard my father moving around slowly downstairs. Then nothing. I hung up the phone, got dressed, and opened the door to the den. My father was slumped in the easy chair, the one my mother had always favored. His hands were clasped over his stomach and his eyes were closed. "Dad?" I whispered. Then I noticed a narrow stream of vomit on the lapel of his ancient maroon bathrobe. "Dad!" I screamed and called 911. The paramedics confirmed that he died of a massive heart attack. Another broken heart? I sobbed into the phone with my husband and brothers. Then I searched for that photo of the 2 of us when I was 5 and we were intertwined. The next day, I made funeral arrangements. I didn't know much about the last years of my father's life. I didn't even have the name of his primary care physician. So I called Reverend Cynthia, with whom I knew he'd grown close. She told me what she could. Then she suggested I reach out to Jeanette Curie, who would know more. The sound of her name enraged me. "How dare you say that to me?" I fumed. I was about to hang up when Reverend Cynthia softly asked, "Would it be okay if I came over?" Soon she was sitting across from me in my parents' living room, sharing revelation upon revelation about the depth of my father's relationship with Jeanette. Since my mother's death, my father had eaten dinner at the Curie's house every night, including the night before he died, she told me. Jeanette's grandchildren called him Grandpa. He helped them with their homework, played with them after school, drove them to church on Sundays. Lee was then in prison on a drug charge, but was going to be paroled to my father upon his release. The details rocked me to my core. The reality was this. My father loved the Curies and had spent more time with them in the latter part of his life than with me or my brothers. How could he have done this to us? How could he care so much for a woman who tormented my mother? I said. But I could tell that Reverend Cynthia didn't see Jeanette the way I did. I wish you could have known my mother, I said through tears. I've heard so many beautiful stories about her, Reverend Cynthia said. I turned to my life in Vermont and tried to wipe Jeanette Curie from my mind. But I kept wondering. About a year and a half after my father died, I wrote to Reverend Cynthia and asked if she would set up a meeting for me with Jeanette Curie. She has many questions that are left unanswered and is hoping you can help her understand her dad better, is how she explained it to Jeanette. I didn't fully know what I hoped to accomplish in our face-to-face, which was to take a place at the church, though there were two lines I'd rehearsed years earlier in case circumstances ever again brought us into contact. You hurt my mother. That's all I know. I need to know about you. I wanted to look into Jeanette's eyes and shout these words, just to make sure she understood. As I entered the church, I steeled myself. My body held as much fear as it did anger. Then I took a seat. Before me sat a slight woman with dark brown eyes, not unlike mine, though her eyebrows were plucked into thin arches. She had deep brown skin and a broad, sculpted nose. She wore a modest gray cap on her head. There was nothing menacing about her. In fact, her smile was impish. I was not charmed. I had questions. Why did you have to start coming to our church, humiliating us, especially my mother? I knew that while ours was an Anglican Episcopal church, Jeanette preferred the Pentecostal tradition where she could shout and praise Jesus. Bernard told me to come. She always called my father by his last name or by Doc. But why would he do that? I wanted to know. She told me he thought that eventually her presence would seem normal and he could enjoy life the way he wanted to, being surrounded at all times by people devoted to him. He'd promised Jeanette that if she did as he asked, including having her husband adopt Lee, he would incorporate Lee into his life. He also promised her me. I would mentor one of her grandchildren, he told her, if she lived according to his rules. I quietly informed Jeanette that my father had never mentioned the name of her grandchild to me, much less the promise he'd made. She lowered her eyes, and I realized suddenly that my father had manipulated her as much as he had us. I remembered a scene from years before, one of the few times I brought my children to church in Nashville. Jeanette had approached me and my then 8-year-old daughter, Isabella, at the passing of the peace. "She's gotten so big," she exclaimed, looking into my eyes as if to share a moment of mutual motherhood. Isabella leaned in for a hug, moved by the warmth and intimacy of Jeanette's words. Instinctively, I put my hand on Isabella's back. I didn't want the hands of this lying woman on my child's body. It dawned on me now, sitting with Jeanette, that my father had encouraged her to think of herself as part of his family while allowing us to assume she'd invited herself in. I asked how she'd known what my daughter looked like. My father had shown her photos, Jeanette said. We had been talking for about an hour. I was confused and tired and needed to collect my thoughts. I started to gather my things when Jeanette blurted, "I just wanted your mother to forgive me. I wanted her forgiveness so bad." I sat back down. The truth of her words pierced the membrane between us. She told me her guilt had inspired her to become a preacher. I felt my shoulders loosen, my jaw unclench, and something inside me began to open. I could see that Jeanette was truly sorry. She was sorry with her whole being. Like my mother, like Jeanette, I believed in God and redemption. If it's a consolation, I told Jeanette. My mother was talking about forgiveness a lot at the end of her life. There's no reason to think that she didn't include you. I was careful with my words. Absolution wasn't mine to give, but Jeanette's relief was visible. We talked for another 2 hours. Jeanette said her sexual relationship with my father had ended as quickly as it had begun. That she had wanted not my father's money, but for him to take an interest in Lee, and eventually encourage my brothers and me to develop a relationship with him. As for the harassing phone calls, Jeanette admitted she hadn't behaved well toward my mother, but her forced secrecy made her desperate to be acknowledged, desperate for legitimacy, and ultimately desperate for my mother's forgiveness, even if she had to bully it out of her. This I now know. If Jeanette was a little crazy in those days, it was in no small measure my father's fault. After my mother died, she explained, all the Curies, Jeanette, Lee, her husband, their children, grandchildren, became my father's family. When Lee went to prison, they worried together and relied on one another. At their house every night, my father settled on the couch to watch sports and the news, insisting that Jeanette's husband Larry sit next to him. Several times, he asked Larry to drive him to visit his investment property in another part of Tennessee. He trusted Larry and always fell asleep at the beginning of the long drive. "Can you believe that?" Jeanette asked me, even though he could have cut his throat. "I can't say I would have blamed him," I said. We laughed, then we hugged, and I got up to leave. "Isn't it nuts that we're communicating like this?" I texted Jeanette recently. "We are learning to trust each other," she responded. "It's been 2 years since our first meeting, and Jeanette and I are getting to know each other. We are on a shared mission, to understand and make peace with the past. When I see her or hear from her, I search inside for that old rage that used to saturate my every cell. But it's gone. Anger never got me any closer to understanding my father or his choices. But through Jeanette, I think I see him more clearly. She sends me Bible passages and memories of my dad. Once she asked me to help her granddaughter with a writing assignment. I agreed without hesitation. Sometimes Jeanette includes love in her text messages to me. Sometimes I send a heart emoji in return. And now for some of the sidebars. Have mercy for author and conversationalist Terry Tempest Williams. Forgiveness is a strength. I think of forgiveness as different sets of triptychs that keep presenting themselves. We are hurt by someone or something, transgression. We are changed by that trauma, either paralyzed in our pain or spurred to face and move beyond it, transition. If we are successful in processing it, we succeed in rising above, stronger, transformation. When I was in Rwanda, I saw extraordinary examples of forgiveness. A woman whose husband and son were murdered found out who the perpetrator was and went to that young man. She said, "I know you killed my son. You killed my husband. You are now my son. We will live with that together and heal." What I saw in Rwanda is that you can forgive without forgetting. Forgiveness is fierce. At this moment in time, it's essential. When we feel powerless, it's forgiveness that enables us to reclaim our power, to begin to melt our hardened souls. Terry Tempest Williams' most recent book is Erosion, Essays of Undoing. Can we forgive ourselves? Edith Eva Eger, an Auschwitz survivor, shows us the way. Dr. Mengele lifted his finger. "Is she your mother or your sister?" he asks. "Mother," I say. As soon as the word is out of my mouth, I want to pull it back into my throat. "Sister, sister, sister," I want to scream. Mengele points my mother to the left. She follows behind the young children and the elderly mothers who are pregnant or are holding babies in their arms. Could I have saved my mother? Maybe. And I will live for the rest of my life with that possibility. And I can castigate myself for having made the wrong choice. That is my prerogative. Or I can accept that the more important choice is not the one I made when I was hungry and terrified, when we were surrounded by dogs and guns and uncertainty, when I was 16. It's the one I make now, the choice to accept myself as I am, human, imperfect. And that was adapted from The Choice by Eva Eger. A Love Supreme. A U.S. Poet Laureate, Joy Harjo, muses on our infinite ability to care. This heart can hold a country, a mountain range, or an island of white birds as the sun comes up and the sun goes down. There are songs of brokenness and songs of putting back together. In this heart will be storm and flood or rain of fire. There is walking away and coming together. There are rooms of emptiness that need to breathe, correction, that need no breath. There are no rooms at all, only fields of flowers. There is always room for children to play. In this heart are oceans with sailing boats to take you home. As for enemies, let them go their own way. This heart has doorways for leaving, for what needs to be left behind. There is always a room for anyone who's gone astray. The heart makes a song of all this. There it is beneath your ribs. It will sing you how to live. It will tell you to forgive. Joy Harjo's most recent book is An American Sunrise, Poems. And where are you going? Molly Sugar, a cyclist, on the Painted Hills Scenic Bikeway, Mitchell, Oregon. I moved from Brooklyn to Portland, Oregon in 2016. Portland appealed to me because of its solid creative community and easy access to nature. I'd been a bike commuter in New York City, and I took that to the extreme for my move. I rode across the country to my new home. After that 2.5-month trip, cycling was no longer something I did just for transportation or fun. It was my passion. It had also introduced me to so many of my friends. I met Jay when I took my bike for a tune-up to the shop where she worked, and brought me closer to others like Janae. But as much as I love cycling, I've been disappointed by how white and male-dominated it can be, especially in Portland. So in 2017, I started a group called Friends on Bikes, which gathers women of color for local events and overnight trips. We break down barriers to entry by providing gear to those who need it, to make sure everyone who's curious about the sport has a chance to develop the same love we have. Next up, I'm doing a 3-month, 2,700-mile ride with my fiancé. The route takes us from the Canadian border all the way to Mexico. We'll carry our house on our bikes, so to speak. Tent, sleeping bag, cooking supplies. Of course, long-distance cycling can be tough. You fall in the middle of nowhere, a chain slips, a tire goes flat. But it doesn't have to be complicated. You just take what you need and leave the rest behind. What I Know for Sure by Oprah. A few months ago, I invited 10 Weight Watchers members, or now it's called WW, and their guests to one of my favorite places on earth to relax and restore, Maui. Sky, ocean, and sunrise over Haleakalai, green fields, rolling hills, forests of eucalyptus trees, and hydrangeas. That's the Maui that calls me home again and again. On my ranch there, I have acres of organic farmland producing every vegetable you ever thought you might want to eat. It's a bountiful life that feels even more gratifying when I can share it. And share we did. Stories of renewal and triumph. There was Jessica, who after losing 71 pounds on WW says she finally understands how taking time to care for herself is good not only for her, but also for her marriage and family. And Gracie, who lost 119 pounds on WW, though she worked in her father's gym before joining. Gracie's weight made her too self-conscious to exercise in front of people. Working the program helped her realize she is capable of that and so much more. Scott lost 25 pounds on WW because heart disease runs in his family, and he and his wife are the parents of 7 children. With so many people depending on him, he knew he had to make changes if he wanted to be there for them over the long haul. After Will lost 49 pounds on WW, he signed up for flying lessons. He says this is the first time in years he's been in control of his health. I thought the time in Maui would be a gift for those members, but now I feel like I'm the one who got the gift. It was an experience I'll cherish forever. The sense of warmth, connection, motivation, and encouragement I felt from each of my guests reminded me again how life-changing WW is, how it gives people a new vision of themselves. Having struggled for so many years with my own weight, I'm well aware of how good it feels to finally know you have the tools to create a balanced approach to eating, a sustainable eating lifestyle. WW has helped me embrace healthy as the new skinny, rather than yo-yo from size to size. I now hold the space where I feel well and strong and fit. Our time in Maui was a celebration of believing you can change old patterns and create not just new habits, but a new way of being. As we closed out the evening with tequila shots and a spontaneous dance party on my front porch, I was left wondering, how can I take the spirit of this one day and share it with as many people as possible? How can I bring together anyone and everyone who wants to spend a day discovering and delighting in everything it means to be well in this life? The answer? We're going on tour. I'm thrilled to announce Oprah's 2020 vision, Your Life in Focus. WW and I will kick things off in January in Fort Lauderdale, then head to Minneapolis, St. Paul, Charlotte, Atlanta, New York City, Dallas, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and Denver, with a few surprise stops along the way. My hope is to help motivate others across the country to make 2020 the year of transformation in all the ways that matter, beginning with their health. My dream is for people to say goodbye to procrastination and denial and staying stuck, simply wishing for a better life. On each stop of the tour, I'll reveal the lessons I've learned on my own health journey and offer help as you write the next chapter of yours. I'll sit down with a different lineup of well-known guests, powerhouse leaders in wellness, and ordinary people from all walks of life who took charge and transformed themselves. And we just might end up having a dance party like we did on my porch. It's been 5 years since I last traveled the USA on a tour. During this election year, when so many want to focus on things that divide us, I believe we can all come together to support a stronger, healthier, more abundant life focused on what makes us thrive. A healthier America that has my vote. I know for sure. See you on the tour. And now moving into women's health. Balancing act. I'm a fashion director, so bodies and the clothes we put on them are quite literally my business. That said, it wasn't a fashion trend that changed my attitude toward my own body. It was trying to have a baby. I struggled with fertility from 2014 to 2017. When I'd had enough of the frustration, I turned my back on the investment, emotional effort, and time spent lingering in waiting rooms to run a marathon. I know it seems weird, but I waited to will my body to do something extraordinary at a time when I felt so out of control. Marathon training is an unexpected relief. I could focus on a singular goal rather than the cruel, frazzled uncertainty of mid to late 30s fertility. And my break from the doctor's offices wasn't a setback. I did ultimately have the baby I was striving for. Ray says hi, everyone. So for me, running and becoming a mom are forever linked. But from this side of parenthood, I haven't yet figured out what fit, healthy mom looks like. It's been more than a year and a half, and I still don't feel right inside or out. It's hard to believe that 6 miles used to feel like a warm-up. I can't even run 2 now. Recently, an IG follower commended my feed. You've gained weight. Thanks. I had a baby, and I did not bounce back. And frankly, F that. I'm not trying to be my pre-mom self, but I'd like to find a way to feel good about the new body I live in, especially now that I have a very observant little girl watching me. I want to figure out how to better take care of myself and a child. Wellness is trendy in the same way that fashion is, but this column is going to be all about realistic, sustainable goals. I'll be working with doctors at Parsley Health and exercise experts at Equinox, and I'm going to share my discoveries with you. My hope is that over the next year, I can learn how to cook like an adult for my family, fuel myself for fitness, master the art of quick, consistent workouts, kick my sugar addiction, and much more. It's time to define what wellness looks like for me. Let's do it. And this was Aya Kanai, Chief Fashion Director. at Women's Health, obviously. Goal getter, finding happy hour. Commute, the one word guaranteed to make everyone cringe, whether you're the driver sitting in traffic for hours or the person turned sardine in the subway, which is why, after more than a year of enduring a twice-daily nightmare, I decided to reclaim my routine with a walking commute, or walk mute, a few nights each week. The result? Moving Meditation by Elizabeth Bacharach. Before heading out for the evening, I change into work clothes. Swapping jeans for spandex not only adds major comfort points, but also helps me get into a different mindset. It's no longer work time, but me time. As a creature of habit, I do what's most comfortable. I like following the same routine daily, so I push myself to try new paths. As a result, I pay more attention to my surroundings, which can foster creativity, says science. To further solidify this walk mute as a me mute, I pop in my pods only to call friends and family. Otherwise, I go tech-free. No texting, no playing music, just listening to what's around me. It's a practice of being present. Living in an urban jungle like New York City means green spaces can be hard to come by, so I always make sure I at least step into Central Park as I head home. Spending time in nature, sans sirens and crowds, is instantly calming. Truth be told, here at Women's Health, we're all about owning our mornings, which for me usually translates to getting a jump start on writing. But on slower days, I try to channel my morning energy into scoring some extra steps. My biggest challenge overall? Being flexible. I started walk muting as a way to minimize stressors, not to add to them. So on days when I can't make all those miles work, I have to remember to take a deep breath and say, okay. And now, one sweat snack, please. Guess what? There's no such thing as a too short workout. On jam-packed days, treat yourself, yes, exercise is a treat, to what we've dubbed the sweat snack. Oh, I'm sorry, I said sweet snack. It is sweat snack. A mini circuit, as in 15 minutes or less. You'll work your muscles, lubricate joints, train your heart rate, and release endorphins, says fitness coach Gideon Akandi. Stick to compound moves that make your upper and lower body work together. They engage your core in the process, like a squat or press, reverse lunge and curl, deadlift and triceps kickback, and minimize rest breaks. Tastes good, doesn't it? Warm up. Ready for relief. Not all recovery tools are created equal. Physical therapist David Reavy, founder of React PT in Chicago, details when and where to call each hero. Best for lower body tightness, the large surface area of a smooth foam roller helps you dig into super achy big muscle groups, like your glutes and quads. Best for small curved areas, a soft, you control the inflation, ball lets you roll out hard to reach spots, like your lats, below your armpit, and pecs, your chest. Best for specific ouch spots, a punctuated massage stick. It allows you to dig into tiny knots like along your calf or IT band. And best for can't walk soreness, vibrations can override pain receptors, which doesn't nix discomfort, but makes you feel less of it. Try this buzzing, travel-friendly, lacrosse-sized ball. Technique school, do yourself solid. Whatever your fit personality, class junkie, lifting lady, cardio queen, the split squat helps fix muscular imbalances and builds deep foundational strength for taking any workout to the next level. Lock it down. The steps? Stand, then step left foot as far forward as possible while keeping both heels planted on the floor, toes pointed forward. Clasp your hands in front of you and hold your torso upright as you bend both knees, allowing the right heel to come off the floor as you shift the weight to the left heel. Lower until your back shin and front thigh are parallel to the floor. Pause, then drive through the left heel to stand up. Watch for a stance too short or wide. Your back shin and front thigh should be nearly parallel to the floor when you lower. Practice the move sideways in front of a mirror to see the angles. You want your feet far enough apart so your front heel stays planted as you squat. Watch for a leaning torso. In order to protect your back and properly engage your glutes, brace your core and keep your upper body directly over your hips. This is especially crucial if you add weights to the move. That first time feeling, marathon on the brain? Go for it. You'll score way more than toned legs. Training for your initial 26.2 makes your blood vessels younger, new research from the European Society of Cardiology reveals. In the study, novice runners who trained for 6 months before crossing the finish line saw a reduction of 4 years in age of their arteries. For instance, they were way less stiff, and a drop in blood pressure, comparable to the effect of meds. Whoa, baby! Next time someone shames you for how hard the big M is on your body, whip out that little number and your well-deserved medal. Practice makes perfect. Well, until it doesn't. Turns out repeating an exercise to the point of exhaustion may impair your ability to learn that skill, as it can prevent your brain from forming memories of the move. Found new research from Johns Hopkins, but whether you're trying a workout, indoor climbing, for the first time or learning a fresh move, pull-ups, how do you know when to persist and when to throw in the towel if your muscles feel shaky or weak? It's best to stop, says exercise physiologist Rachel Straub, co-author of Weight Training Without Injury. Be sure to start at a low intensity for strength training. Use little or no weight when learning a lift. If you're guinea-pigging a class, focus on form over pace, even if that means missing a hill or cycling, a few reps in bar, or a pose in yoga. Dude, where's my sleep? Even if you've never heard of acute insomnia, chances are you've experienced it. A loss of sleep, or worse, Z's, lasting several consecutive evenings. The usual suspect, as you've probably guessed, stress. Anxiety about, say, a presentation, can cause a state of hyperarousal, yes, even after the stressful event is over, in which constant bursts of adrenaline make calming down beyond challenging. But with the right mind-taming tricks, you can end the nightmare. Consider this your Take Back the Night action plan. Skip the early bedtime. Exhausted? Hitting the hay sooner than usual will likely lead to your lying in bed wide awake and frustrated. Instead, get back on track by focusing less on shut-eye. Catch up on a more relaxing activity like coloring or reading to wind down for your usual lights-out hour. Try coherent breathing. Sitting in a comfortable position, inhale for 6 seconds and exhale for 6 seconds for at least 2 full minutes. The technique has been shown to activate the vagus nerve, in turn decreasing heart rate, blood pressure, and overall tension. Keep a worry log. Before you turn off the light, write down any thoughts, like tomorrow's to-do list, that tend to flood your mind the minute you go horizontal. This gives your brain the opportunity to file the day away and serves to truly declutter your head. Ticker tricks. Blood pressure. The force of your blood hitting your artery walls is only a concern if you're not active, right? We wish. Because even the women's health staff is guilty of these seemingly innocent blood pressure spikers. Knocking back espresso. We're team coffee every day, but caffeine doesn't just affect you in the moment, it can raise your pressure over time. Cap Daily Joe and tea at 3 cups. Psst, that's about the size of a venti. If you've had elevated numbers at the doc, work to phase it out altogether. Popping NSAIDs. Oh, our go-to cure for sore muscles. But pain meds like naproxen and ibuprofen can up your blood pressure because they impact kidney function. So skip them or stick to a short-term dose, 4 days in a row, tops. If you have a heart condition or unhealthy numbers, or try a muscle-soothing cream made of essential oils. Eating a tyramine-inducing diet. WTH, which is what the hell, is triamine, a compound produced when amino acid triosine breaks down, which happens when you eat strong cheeses, cured meats, and soy. Too much tea can cause hypertension, so limit those foods.
Ooh.
Clear eyes, can't lose. ICYDK, traditional red eye drops, can do the exact opposite of what they're intended to do because they constrict the eye's vessels to temporarily nix that bloodshot look. They limit oxygen supply, which can create rebound redness and inflammation hours or even days later, presenting a lasting solution, Lumify. Unlike typical options, Lumify drops act primarily on a different type of receptor. We'll spare you the scientific name. That doesn't affect blood flow at all, so you get white peepers without the worry. One women's health editor brought them for a dry weekend in Colorado and never needed a second squeeze. Underwear? Remember when period underwear was code for the gross granny panties you buried in your drawer for emergencies? Ha! Now the phrase describes the increasingly popular, eco-friendly alternative to tampons, masquerading as a pair of cute cheekies. Made with moisture-wicking fabric that absorbs blood and prevents yeast or bacterial overgrowth, they're just as safe as pads, but reusable. Plus, brands such as Thins, Nix, and Dear Kate design them to avoid odor, leakage, and stains. So no need to worry about anyone knowing what's under your jeans. On your heaviest days, bring another pair to change into after 4 to 8 hours, just to be extra cautious and comfier. Then wash them as soon as possible after wearing. A quick rinse, cold wash, no softener, no bleach, and hang dry will do it. Ask Dr. White, what's the difference between a polyp and a fibroid and a cyst? And which is most concerning? Answer, pelvic pain or abnormally heavy bleeding can indicate one of these three pesky growths, but usually none are worrisome. A cyst is most often a bubble on the surface of an ovary, like a golf ball-sized blister filled with fluid, occasionally blood or mucus. A polyp is a fleshy, worm-like growth on the inside of your cervix or uterus, and a fibroid is a round mass of muscle and fibrous cells in your uterus. If any of these, confirmed via an ultrasound, become large enough to obstruct your anatomy or cause chronic issues, your gyno may recommend surgery. Don't stress. Since these things are common, the procedures are too, meaning they're typically low risk for you and simple for your doc. Birth control with benefits. You know birth control regulates your flow and prevents pregnancy. A win! And you might know that it could lower your risk for uterine and ovarian cancers. Bonus win! But there's so much more these little pills or patches or implants or IUDs do for your body. Like, 1. Protect your knees. Active ladies, take note. Oral contraceptives may lower the risk for ACL tears in athletes because they control monthly hormone surges that can impact injury risk, found a new study in The Physician and Sports Medicine. 2. Ease migraines. The nasty headaches on steroids are linked to a drop in estrogen that occurs right before your period. So an uninterrupted, placebo-free birth control regimen, like a continuous pill, implant, or IUD, can prevent these fluctuations and decrease migraine severity. And 3, improve daily energy. Fatigue and weakness could be a sign of low red blood cells, anemia. The pill minimizes heavy bleeding by preventing ovulation and causing the shedding of a thinner uterine lining. You lose fewer oxygenating cells, so you feel stronger. Shake it up. What's old is new again, at least when it comes to healthy snack aisle. Freshen your favorites with these more nutritious options created from ancient power foods, because life is too short to eat the same thing every day. If you like popcorn, you'll love popped water lily. Water lilies have seeds, and when roasted, they turn out puffed and airy. One serving of the aquatic plant has 3 grams of protein, amino acids, and half the fat, or less, of most popcorn. Plus, it's grain-free. Try brands like Ta'ali, Bohana, and Makana. If you like crispy chickpeas, you'll love lupini beans. This Italian super bean, which looks like a tan lima bean, has about 50% more protein and fiber than garbanzos or chickpeas, and way fewer carbs and calories. Snack on the pickled version right out of the bag. Brahmi has 5 varieties, or toss them in salads. If you like peanuts, you'll love Baru nuts. These aren't pretty. They look like rabbit poo. But the legumes, surprise, taste just like peanuts. They have more digestible protein and fiber than almonds, with less fat and no known allergens. Crunch on the seeds, grind them into butter, or find the flour form. If you like chips or pretzels, you'll love cassava flour anything or everything. The root veggie cassava is taking over packaged snacks as a grain-free alternative to corn and wheat. As a flour, it gives the same crunchy satisfaction and savory taste. Find it in chips from Plant Snacks and Siete, or crackers from the ground up made with cauliflower. Sticker Stumper. Americans waste 40% of their food each year, partly due to confusing expiration labels, because they're not standardized. The FDA is trying to change that. You're left with a fridge full of, huh? A translation? Sell-by. Think of this, and its sister Display Until, as a message from the manufacturer to the grocer, advising the best time for an item to be purchased by rather than an end date for its optimal quality. The latter is actually at least a few days after this date. 1 to 2 days for chicken, 1 week for milk, 3 weeks for eggs. Use by. Along with best by and enjoy by, the stamp usually indicates when food will be at its peak in flavor and texture. But in rare cases, that dang lack of standardization, the label means that consuming it after the printed date could be harmful. So stick to the date on deli meats, unpasteurized cheeses, and pre-made sammies, which carry a higher risk for listeria, and do the sniff test for the rest. Unwrapped. Processed foods can up your risk for heart disease and diabetes and lead to overeat and gain weight. New research has shown. But what processed means isn't always so black and white, says Michael Hertz, a dietitian in New York City. Peep this spectrum that experts use for all the shades of gray. Unprocessed natural foods. These are the cleanest eats you can get. Soil may be included and come straight from the ground or animal. Think squash from the farmer's market, beets at a farm-to-table cafe. Minimally processed. These get a tune-up like fruit that's washed or milk that's pasteurized. Processes may affect the food. We see you, bruises, but don't add anything, so nutrients remain intact. Processed. These have salt, sugar, and/or oil to preserve or make food tastier. Think canned beans, salted nuts, hummus, cheese. They have only a few ingredients, so are close enough to the original to eat regularly. Moderately processed. With about 5 ingredients, these guys have natural sweeteners, honey, and preservatives, vinegar. Your clean snacks may fall here. Not bad for you, but best in moderation. And ultra-processed. Ugh, these boxed or bagged yums, even the healthy ones, have more than 5 ingredients from hydrogenated oils to fats and sugars for serious shelf life and taste. You lose nutrients and can put on pounds because inflammation. Crack one open. Clap your hands. It's pomegranate season. The tart, seedy fruit doesn't just taste distinctly delish. Its juice and seeds are packed with antioxidants, anti-inflammatory properties, which may reduce the risk for cancer, and nutrients like fiber, potassium, and vitamin C and K. How to enjoy. De-seed. Slice the pomegranate in 2 and 1/2 at a time. Tap the outside with a wooden spoon as the aerils, which are also known as the seeds, fall out into a bowl. Warning, the juice will stain, so cut with caution. Juice. Blend the aerils and strain into a glass. Try it pre-workout. It's natural nitrates, can up oxygen flow to your muscles, research has shown. Mix. Aerials punch up everything from sweet treats like yogurt and smoothies to savory ones like salads, bruschetta, and rice dishes. Blend. Toss Aerials, EVOO, balsamic vinegar, and Italian seasonings into a blender for a salad dressing or marinade for meats and veggies. And scoop. Of course, you can always collect the Aerials in a bowl and eat them for, which is our favorite way, by the spoonful. Lazy? By packaged pom-poms from Palm Wonderful. For your mind, meet the pose. Ditch the wine and turn off those reruns of The Office. There's a better end of the day ritual to chill you out. The L pose, or legs up the wall, or Viparita Karani. It stimulates your vagus nerve, which governs your sympathetic fight or flight and parasympathetic rest and digest nervous systems simultaneously. The result? You're left feeling totally refreshed, not tired, yet not wired. Here's how to do it. Sit next to a wall with your legs straight in front of you. Lie back as you rotate your torso away from the wall and bring your legs up against it, forming an L shape with your body. Inch your butt as close to the wall as possible using a folded blanket for extra cushioning if needed. Hold for 5 to 20 minutes and just breathe. Flip your palms up if you need to receive self-love down to feel grounded. The art of noticing. Focus on this. Being mindful is the healthy habit of 2019, but how you actually become an always aware person? Journalist Rob Walker, author of The Art of Noticing, has an idea. Actually, 131 of them. A favorite, make a sound map in which you explore a familiar neighborhood, concentrating on the sounds of the area. Noticing isn't just visual. It takes all of our senses. Pick 3 to 5 sounds you think of as sonic landmarks. A church bell, noisy birds, a car alarm, he says. Then make a mental note of where and when you heard those landmarks, and recall them each time you pass that spot. You'll learn to pay legit attention to your surroundings and fine-tune your listening and recall skills in the process. And that will end this week's Women's Hour. I'm Briley Colton, a volunteer reader here at Sun Sounds of Arizona. I encourage you to get out there and enjoy that woman's world around you. Have a good one.